And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome to the 10th night of Millennial 2025. And there are 5 streams coming at it tonight. In 2 hours, I'll be with Old Sterling, and then Wilhelm Iverson, and then the Delphica Society, and then there's the Winter Solstice AMA. Because, tomorrow is the Winter Solstice. But first, I am with John Waters, and John is a regular or millennial. I think this is the 4th or 5th time you've appeared. So welcome back, and I'll...
Thank you very much, Colin.
Yeah. Okay, and just for the benefit of anyone who doesn't know, can you introduce yourself briefly?
Briefly? I used to be a journalist back in the day. I worked in the Irish Times for many years, and I withdrew about a decade ago and from journalism mainstream. I began to see how corrupt it was becoming, and not anticipating just how corrupt it could become, and which is now total. So I'm now on Substack. I've been on Substack for the last 5 years, johnwaters.substack.com. And unfortunately, I got to tell you, Colin, that one also is beginning to look a little bit weird. We might get into that. I've written some a dozen books, something like that. I used to write plays way back. Haven't done it for a good few years. Kind of interested in getting back and doing it again, because I think maybe theatre might be a way to go at some of this stuff rather differently, rather than essays and articles. And that's kind of it, really. I'm on Substack. I'm on Twitter, but I don't even go there. I don't even look at my account anymore because it's so disgusting. I just stopped putting out stuff, except very occasionally if there's some very particular reason that I have to put something up. But almost nobody looks at it because nobody knows where I am.
Well, it's linked in the description, so some more people know where it is now.
Okay, good. Well, I still won't post anything.
You don't like Twitter? You said you found it disgusting. Is that the general tenor? What is it that you don't like?
I've always had that view, and I went for election in Ireland last year in the European elections, just as an experiment, and I was convinced, I was persuaded to go on Twitter for this purpose. And I did that, and I tried hard to kind of do something decent with it, but I gave up in the end because I was just being shadow banned. But I went back then to my original kind of conclusion, which is that Twitter is a blight on the face of the planet. You know, that it always struck me that it was such a reductionist, medium, so kind of crass and trivial and stupid, really. I haven't really changed that view. I used to say repeatedly that in 100 years or whatever, when there are anthropologists wherever in the world wishing to investigate the reasons for the complete collapse of Western civilization in the first half of the 21st century, they will dive into the ruins of the civilization and pour around with their microscopes and so on for a few months and emerge with a single piece of paper. And on that piece of paper will be one word, and that word will be Twitter. That was the reason for the collapse of Western civilization, for sure. I think you can trace pretty much all of what's going wrong. Wouldn't have been possible without this kind of reductionist, hyper-democratic form of communication, which really brings the most ignorant and the stupid to the surface, and that's almost the definition of what's happened to us. Because otherwise, we would have, people are running. Smart people, intelligent people, thoughtful people are running scared of stupid, ignorant people on Twitter.
That is a sort of a terrible injustice when you see some stupid tweet, some stupid remark, and you look at the person's profile and you realize that they've got far more followers than you, and you know it's a moron. You know it's an idiot.
Yeah.
Ignorant, full of themselves, doesn't even realize their own limitations, would laugh if you tried to tell them that they're mediocre. And would mock you for having a smaller account than them. And,
yeah, or it's a bot.
I've had this on...
Or it's a bot. Because, my wife points out... Sometimes my wife looks on Twitter and she'll read out a tweet to me. And then she'll tell me, like, the number of tweets that this individual has actually posted in the last, whatever, 5 years. And it's, like, an impossible level of tweeting. So these are mechanical, accounts, which is just whatever, by whatever algorithm, are generating some kind of responses to whatever. I don't know how it works and don't really care. And that's it. But sorry, I interrupted you. I beg your pardon.
Well, it's a problem. The big thing about the internet and then social media was that it would democratize everything. That was the word at the time. I'm sure you remember hearing it in the 2000s. It's going to democratize such and such. And you get it later with cheap gadgets, a cheap camera that democratizes filmmaking and so on. Mm. And it sounds good. And you can understand why people get on board with it. But then you realize what it means is that the lowbrow will win out. I remember a large YouTuber saying to me that his ideas must be better than mine because he has more followers than me. Mm. And I couldn't. Quite, because he'd won in the marketplace of ideas of followers, and I couldn't quite get him to understand. No, that's because there are more idiots than intelligent people.
Exactly.
So there are more people who will fall for your drivel than will understand, frankly, what I regard as wise ideas from me. Because it sounds vain and all that, but just leave me out of it. It's still a fact that there are more morons who will understand lowbrow tripe than intelligent people who will understand intelligent truth.
And by the way, Colin, I'd pick you up there on something. When you kind of said this may be vain. I actually think we should stop apologizing before we kind of claim the value of what we do. I'm not accusing you anyway, but because I do it as well. But I think because there's a great Irish poet called Patrick Kavanagh who used to say, we should tell the truth even when it's in favor of ourselves. Always tell the truth, no matter even if it sounds like you're boasting or whatever, because there are an awful lot of stupid people out there, and they are actually destroying the world in that hyper-democratic way that they have now access to. And nobody's there to call this out anymore, you see. The media being so corrupt.
They need to be taken by the scruff of the neck. I mean, that's what they need. That's what they've always needed. The masses have always needed to be just told, here's how it is, believe it and shut up. Now, obviously, there are exceptions where those in charge are abusing the masses and abusing the common man, of course. But even then, they still need to be organized by someone else. I mean, it just seems to be human nature. But if we're talking in terms of IQ, then yeah, half of people have an IQ less than 100. But then it's not just a matter of IQ. It's not just a matter of raw intelligence. It's also thoughtfulness, honesty, courage. There are all sorts of facets that are necessary in order to actually grasp the truth and see and speak.
Ultimately, it's about individuality. And that struck me very much recently when I was doing a particular project. Looking back into the past and looking into back into my own family's past, that actually my parents and my uncles and aunts, they all had very distinct personalities. They always kind of had dogged views of the world, and they could defend them and they would defend them. And so I grew up listening to all kinds of arguments between all kinds of people. My father had a mail car, which is kind of like a stagecoach, Dream mails and newspapers around the countryside, and he used to also carry passengers, and there could be 10, 12, 14 people in the back of the van, no seats, sitting on mail bags and boxes and tires and arguing like all the way, and this was the norm then. Now everybody says the same thing. Everybody you know, certain categories of people, they have absolutely uniform views about everything. You know, you can actually ask them one question and get the answer to that one question, and then you can write a profile of them in every other domain of life and existence. This is an extraordinarily new thing that really doesn't get much comment about it, you know, and it's been policed like this. You know, it is now an offence, it is now a crime to not have the same view about everything, and for that view to be the particular view that is approved by the establishment, because ultimately that's what it amounts to. It's all establishmentarianism. It's not in any way rebel, it is not in any way dissident, it's not in any way dissenting. It's, you know, simply...
Or even organic.
No, it's not organic. So, I mean, it's quite... And yet these people think of themselves as highly individualized people because they wear a particular style of Nike runners or something. You know, it's bizarre. But I remember I was saying this the other day in a particular context, because somebody asked me about my father, you know, who's a very unusual kind of man, even in the context I'm talking about. But he was a very, very upright and principled man, and very, very hardworking, and very, very, yeah, he didn't use bad language, all that kind of stuff. But I say, you know, he wore rags, like he didn't dress up, he went out with, like a tramp, really. But he was very well educated by himself. And now he would be regarded as a character, that terrible term in that context, or, you know, eccentric. And I say, what occurred to me just as I was thinking about this, then everybody was eccentric. You know, there was nobody in the center as such. Everybody was eccentric because they were themselves.
This does seem to be a thing with the British Isles. That obviously, I include Ireland here. There was a tremendous tolerance for eccentricity. To the point where, as you say, it's almost like everyone was eccentric to an extent. I mean, I remember my mother telling, she grew up in a town called Bowness, which is in central Scotland, and she had so many stories about the adults when she was a child, the characters, sorry to use that word, of that town when she was growing up. And it was like every second person was some kind of colourful personality and sort of disagreeable, opinionated, a bit dysfunctional.
Yeah, well, it's interesting just thinking about that word characters in that context, because we know the word character has, you know, the obvious thing of, you know, a good character, or, you know, a man of character, that kind of thing. But in the other context, it is... It probably derives from the idea of the character in a play. You know, in other words, that it is a strongly drawn, well-drawn person with somebody with particular quality characteristics,
yes,
which are very
distinct.
Strong. Yes. But the problem is that in time, it has become debased and has become quite condescending towards people who, you know, in their time were very particular about their positions and their behaviors, and indifferent. They didn't care about what people thought of them. That's essentially the kind of criterion, I think. And that's, again, Patrick Kavanagh, whom I mentioned. That was the thing that he said that he'd learned the most important thing he'd learned in his life. Towards the end of his life, he'd had a bout of cancer and he was probably dying. But he was sitting on the banks of the Grand Canal in Dublin one day, and he said, realized that the most important thing in life was not caring. And by that he meant not caring what people thought of you. Just be indifferent. And that's something that now is almost impossible for people, because there are so many kind of eyes on them in years listening to them and watching, listening.
Consequences if they are out of line in any way.
Yeah, exactly.
As you said, about that's why everyone has the same opinion. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I think that's the thing. Like, this is a new situation. And again, it's amazing when these situations come into being, and, you know, something like this, it is assumed, we automatically sort of decide, well, it's always been like this. But of course it hasn't. You know, and then we kind of wonder why certain things are happening. but we never actually look at the factors which actually really explain it. When you actually, tabulate them and set them out for people to see. You say, how could it be otherwise when you have a culture like this? How could it be other than that we are obedient, quiescent, meek in the face of abuse and tyranny when we have been abused in this way ourselves?
Yeah, I think another factor is that culture, the culture that we consume, receive, absorb, has become homogenized. I mean, and this is much worse for young, I'm in my 40s, it's much worse for teenagers now. I mean, when I was a teenager, there was still much more British culture and even Scottish culture. I think that has now become a sort of pastiche. Like they'll just, make something out of plastic and put tartan on it, and that's a Scottish memento or something, whatever. Mm. But in terms of TV and film, I think all of it has become homogenized. And I mean, the young are watching YouTube and TikTok. They're not watching, the television. And I don't, and there's a whole lot you could say about television, but it's bad and whatever. But nonetheless, at least it still fostered a sense of usness. It was our culture, it was our history, it was our locations, our geography, our climate, our history.
Well, yeah,
and all I of think, that is now subsumed by this awful globalized crap on Netflix, which is made for everyone and therefore no one, and doesn't speak of any particular culture. In fact, it can't. It mustn't.
Yeah,
because that reduces the profitability.
And very soon it'll all be produced by AI. Which is just regurgitating old ideas in different formulations. But, but at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily damn TV, quiet TV, because in the early stages, I think, TV was actually quite good. It was like the BBC did really good dramas way back in the 60s, There was really good investigative programs like World in Action and all those kind of programs, Panorama when it was good.
Horizon was a good documentary series as well, I remember. Yeah.
And serious discussions and things like, remember BBC Two did the Late Show with Paul Morley, which is a fantastic program, looking at arts and culture and talking about in a way that this kind of oblique way that he had about society, That's all gone. It's a terrible. TV is not TV anymore in that sense.
It's funny you mention this now because, and I don't want to derail this because there's so much that we could talk about here. But just last night, I ventured back to the BBC for the first time in years. Actually, I watched the new Doctor Who just for research, purely for research purposes. But other than that, I haven't watched TV or whatever for years. But yesterday or the day before on Twitter, someone mentioned The Moral Maze. And I used that as a Radio 4 program, discussion program.
Yeah.
And I used to listen to The Moral Maze like 10, 15 years ago. And I thought, he said something quite positive about this latest episode of The Moral Maze. So I thought, I'll dip back into it and see what it's like. last night after the millennial streams were done, I went and downloaded this latest episode of The Moral Maze, and what a waste of time. What an absolute waste of time. I think it was 50 minutes long, and it was just crap.
I know.
And this is highbrow stuff. This is the best. And it was just an exercise in gatekeeping and homogenizing the discourse. They had this guy on who described himself as a Christian nationalist, and they made him swear blind that he wasn't a racist. He didn't care about ethnicity. It was just about the faith. And so then, if everyone's African but Christian, is it still England? That's what they boxed him into saying. So then this is where the discourse is then. So, we can all be replaced, but as long as we're Christian, no difference.
Yeah, everything is
outrageous.
everything is ideologized, whatever the word is. Everything is ideology,
Just one last thing. The feeling I got was that these are people. It's four people and Michael Burke, the presenter, and I like Michael Burke, but it was a bunch of intelligent people who simply were not grasping or even attempting to grasp the reality of Britain today. And this is what other people have said. So
because they know there's a price for grasping it in public. That you're risking everything. I know people who've even recently, to the extent that I thought this cancel culture had begun to wane. I mean, in recent times, I've seen really good people taken out completely, wiped out because of one particular intervention they might have made, you know? So it is absolutely policed. Policed is the word, by all of these dark forces and their minions everywhere, at every street corner, behind every screen, they're watching. And this is something that I discovered this a good few, well, maybe a decade or so ago. I was going to hospital and, you know, I used to love Radio 4, BBC Radio 4, and I wrote some plays for the BBC and on radio plays, and so I felt part of it, you know, and I loved programs like Start the Week on Radio 4. It was always good, you know, really deep, interesting discussions, and you know, all kinds of the plays would be good, and you know, all this, yeah, and I decided, oh, I'm going to the hospital for a week, you know, so I buy myself a radio and listen to one that will pick up Radio 4. So I got an internet radio, and I thought, oh, great. I turned it on the first day in the hospital, and I started listening to Radio 4, and then I switched over to World Service. I listened there for another maybe half an hour, and then I switched it off, and I haven't switched it on since. I couldn't bear. The same tenor was in everything. Same ideology, was discernible in virtually every sentence uttered on that on those programs.
And how would you describe that tenor and that ideology?
Well, it's all the stuff that we talk about. It's all the stuff that started with political correctness, which was such this sort of anodyne kind of sounding thing of being polite to certain minorities and blah, blah. But in fact, was the thin end of an enormous tyranny, which culminated in woke and all that stuff and cancel culture. And it's like basically, you know, thou shalt, you know, it's a new set of commandments, a new kind of constitution for Western civilization, which is basically the victim is king, the omnipotent victim, and thou shalt honor the omnipotent victim at all times. And all the logic of that then, you know, which is that you have to dishonor your own people in order to achieve that and so on.
And that everything we've built and everything we've achieved is basically invalid. It's just, it has to be now questioned and deconstructed, destroyed. Yeah. Decolonized, as they say.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I heard somebody recently in a particular context talking about Ireland and saying that this person said that they had worked in Australia for some time, and you know, that while they were there, it was, you know, they felt proud of being Irish, of course, yes, of course, but also, you know, ashamed because of Ireland's colonial history. And I said, sorry, what colonial history would that be then? You mean being on the receiving end of colonialism? No, what this person had in mind was priests and nuns going out to Africa and teaching the natives how to pray and so on. And I said, so that's kind of on a level with King Leopold II cutting off people's hands, is it? Like, you know, what? You know, like the lack of disproportion, but that's the adherence. I mean, you can't go wrong with that kind of madness. If you become that mad, then you will do well. You will prosper in this culture.
Yeah, if you're completely poised against your native culture and your history, then you'll be rewarded. But if you've got some sort of sneaking admiration for it, then you're screwed. You're not going to have a career. You're not going to, I mean, and that means everything. You're not going to have the family. You're not going to have the nice house. You're not going to have the car. So it's that sort of existential. It's that absolute. If you want to have a life at all, then, you know, except on the dole or something, then
that's right.
You're going to have
that's
to
exactly right.
voice all this bullshit.
That's right. Like in the past, you could dissent. You could be anything you want. You could say what you wanted. You could say what you believe. You could argue. You mightn't be popular, but you still have a life. Maybe you might make yourself unpopular with certain people. You would be kind of pointed to, oh, that's that guy, he's whatever. Fine. But you still have a life. Nobody questions your right to be part of the society, per se, just because you had views that were literally eccentric in the sense that that means literally outside of the center. Now, if you're outside the center, you're not simply wrong. You're actually evil.
They will find a way of making... a moral quality now to disagreement with the consensus. Yes. It's seen as a moral crime.
Yes, a failure, a moral failure, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's so insidious. I mean, it's so insidious. Like in the schools in Ireland now, they're apparently teaching the children about white privilege. You know, and I enjoy telling people about my white privilege, which is like growing up in a house which didn't have electricity, didn't have running water, where we had two functional rooms between six of us. You know, like white privilege, really? Really? You were there, were you? You know, what's white privilege like? What's white? I'm not white. You know, like this is all bullshit that has been imported from other places and appropriated and weaponized and used against, as you say, the host populations of Western countries in order to asset strip those countries. It's essentially, I mean, like just as the mass migration influx, which is an invasion, an orchestrated invasion to replace the national, the indigenous population with planted aliens. That's kind of, you know, that's the object of that is to obtain vacant possession of our countries, so that there will be an insufficient number of people living in each country who remember their history and culture, who honor it, who believe that their country belongs to them, who claim their country. For all the others, it will be just a piece of territory upon which they walk across on their way to some to consume something or perhaps occasionally to produce something. Who knows? The miracles may happen. You know? Well, that's this is the absolutely unprecedented thing that is happening now, and anybody
so it works hand in hand with that. So there's the immigration, the physical replacement of us, but what we are talking about is the discrediting of us,
yes,
and also the invalidating of us. So we don't even exist. So there's nothing to be replaced.
It immobilizes people that because it silences them. I call it mutism. You know, they're muted. And therefore, there is no discourse which suggests that this is a problem very much in the mainstream. Therefore, it isn't a problem. And politicians say, well, nobody else seems to be objecting to, you know, so, you know, you're just a far-right fascist.
And this was the thing in the moral maze that I listened to. The all of their thinking brought them, and it kept repeatedly bringing them to the conclusion that, well, okay, you might have complaints about this situation, but any complaints mean that you're racist.
Yes.
So.
Oh yeah.
So you can't have it. You've just got to forget about your complaints.
Even to ask a question isn't approved of is racist. If you ask, well, how many of these people are we expected to absorb before we stop being racists? That's itself
and
a racist question.
How many of our women have to be raped before we're not racist?
Yeah.
How many of our schoolgirls have to get raped before we're not racist?
Or how is it? Yeah, this is a very, really good question, Colin, you know, which I've asked. How come for the last, 40, 50 years, we heard incessantly that, you know, violence against women was a really bad thing? Rape was a terrible thing. These are the most egregious crimes that any, you know, can be committed in our society. And no, they're not. Provided you are an omnipotent victim who commits such a crime.
Yeah. Well, this is the victim hierarchy where non-whites always outcompete women. So if it's a white woman, then she's got privilege, whereas her black rapist does not have privilege. So she's got more of it than he has at any rate. So
yeah, well, she has no rights then. Yeah. She has rights only in inverse proportion to whoever her assailants lack of privilege. You know, it's an astonishing formula, an extraordinary equation that we're constructing. And grown-up people with long trousers are actually articulating these things as if they were commonsensical principles.
And this is the frustrating thing, that you and I can say this stuff and the general public would, I don't know, just dismiss both of us as racists for saying this. So
I'm not part of that. I think it depends on who's listening. I think it depends on whether they're being overheard or whether they think they're being overheard. I think there's this bifurcation now in the public realm whereby it seems people are, I think, becoming aware but not quite ready to speak yet about what they become aware of.
Yeah, I agree with you, and this is what I see really having changed this year, where it started last year with the Southport incident in Britain, but this year it's stepped up with Epping and then the Afghan scandal, the asylum scandal, and various other small things along the way, but especially the rape gang stuff at the start of the year. Mm-hmm. I think sort of enabled, authorized people to feel a certain way for the first time, that they'd been sublimating, they'd been denying for years. And so now and that's why it's weird to hear the moral maze last night, because I thought, you haven't advanced at all. You're still stuck 15 years ago. The country is changing around you, and you're having to maintain this line from 15 years ago. You're fossilized. Mm. Because, as you say, I agree with you that something is now changing for the first time.
Yes.
The situation that we've been lamenting has really held for the last 20 years, I would say, from 2005, 2000 maybe, through to the early 2020s. But now it is finally starting to change. Now, we're still left with the lingering problem of cultural homogenization. So we don't have what you were talking about, the eccentrics, the open disagreement and debate. I wonder if people even know how to debate anymore. How do they know how to have an argument in a pub without it becoming a police incident? I'm not sure.
This is a very interesting aspect of it, that which I even noticed in myself. You know, that I don't know why this is. Maybe you have some ideas. That I find myself becoming more heated within myself in an argument now than I would have 20, 25 years ago. I mean, then you could have discussions on TV, on radio, in the pub, wherever, and the participants would be hammer and tongs at each other on the issues. But there was no personal rancor.
Yeah. I think it's because the stakes are higher now. You know that the stakes are. You know, there's a funny, when you were talking about good TV from back in the day, and I think we can go up to the early mid-90s with that. Mm. I like dramas from the 70s, but it was still quite good up until the 90s. There was a show, you'll know it. It was that discussion show late night. I don't know if it was Paul Morley. I don't know if it was the one where they'd have a bunch of celebrities sitting around a table.
And that was Channel 4. Like, yeah. What was that called? Yeah. Channel 4. It was after midnight. And it would go on for hours.
Here's the funny thing that, what's his name, that actor, Keith Allen. He's now a complete woke lefty. I saw an old episode of that program, whatever it was called. Let me see if I can find what it was called. Oliver, I'll find it via Oliver Reed, because he, yeah, there was an incident on that show. Kate Millett. What was it called? Right, I think I've got it. After Dark.
Yes.
Yes, that was it, After Dark. So, yeah, and so I saw an old episode of with Keith Allen, and he told a racist joke on that show. And this is like 1993 or something. He told a racist joke, and then he laughed at his own joke, and then he told it twice. He told it a second time to someone else who hadn't heard it the first time. And I thought, wow. You know, and this guy is now a complete woke-tard.
Wow. You see, this is on. Yeah, and he probably would deny that to.
Oh yeah, but not the joke wasn't even a very good one. He was talking about a Pakistani guy, and he said he hasn't got a chip on his shoulder; he's got a vindaloo. And it's not that clever, you know.
No,
but he thought it was hilarious, so he then told it to a second person who hadn't heard it.
Yeah, this is you see, really. There's a tendency often to, when we talk about events and changes in society, to imagine that there are obviously and, you know, self-evidently organic. But of course, that's the last thing they are. You know, all of us are victims within this of being pushed along and almost, as I say, policed. You know, it's like there's a tyranny there already, even though it's not necessarily it hasn't got batons or guns or fire hoses or anything like that. It's some form of subtle. You see, it goes back to that idea that, you know, the most frightening thing to the human being is to be, it's not even death, it's to be cast out of the tribe. Because, you know, through history, through the vast, the greater part of history, if you were thrown out of the tribe, you basically perished because, you know, you wouldn't fend for yourself. It was too dangerous and you wouldn't be able to eat and so on. And I think that thing is what's policing people. That the idea of cancellation is much more powerful than we kind of focus on most of the time. It's not just that you lose your livelihood, and which is terrible, of course, and I know all about it, but it's that you actually are a complete pariah, complete outcast.
Well, it's that awful feeling that other people think badly of me, other people are talking badly about me, other people are telling more new people something bad about me.
Yes.
And you can get quite paranoid. This conflicts with what you were saying earlier, that you've got to try not to care what other people think about you.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Both are true at once. You know?
That's right. That's right. That's the ideal, not care. And you see, I think there's something that we do, and I do it, is pretend not to care. You know, which isn't the same thing at all, you know, because you try to convince yourself, no, it doesn't matter, words, sticks and stones and all that, you know, but actually words do hurt you. And
they can do damage as well.
Yes, but I think the worst thing of all, Colin, is the idea of being unjustly described. When you hear, you know, in a certain sense, you know, if you say something and you know, it might be a mistake or whatever, yeah, you own up to maybe making a slip of the tongue. And that used to be permissible as well, you know, to say, well, can I rephrase that? Can I withdraw that? Is that all right? No, it's there now forever. But it's just this idea that you are now, you know, we're cast out completely on the basis of things we say, things we believe. But sometimes we may not even have said those things. Sometimes we may not even have even believed those things. It may be unfair, but there's nowhere to go to make that point. You know, you're not allowed into the mainstream to actually correct the things that are being said about you there. I mean, recently I was involved in a festival which it's called Mishaera, which means it comes from a title of a poem by Páraig Pearce, the hero of 1916. And the leader of the revolution, And it means my Ireland, or I am Ireland, actually, in a sense, you know, Mishéire. And this festival was to organized by people like us, right? To focus on Irish culture, to focus on the moment and you know, the loss that was imminent as a result, that kind of thing. And of course, it was immediately attacked by the Blue Hairs, and they went to all the corrupt media, and they got like loads of so-called artists to sign a petition, and it gave them a big thing. But we stood up for them, and we managed to actually get the festival on, and it was a huge success. Really fantastic. Like, it was 1,000 people in Downcastle Bar. The first venue was cancelled in Drumshambo in Leitrim, but we got to Mayo, to this hotel in Castle Bar, and it was a huge success. And, you know, but I was being pilloried all over the place, but it was one particular paper at the Mirror, which continually described me as a far-right writer. So, in the end, I just kind of wrote this polite letter to the editor, the news editor, and any other editor I could think of within the organization to make sure that it made landfall, you know. I said, well, you know, I've been a journalist and a writer in Ireland now for 40 years, and I've written 12 books, and I've written thousands of articles. And, you know, when I was a journalist in working in newspapers, every so often we would have a seminar in-house, you know, teaching us, reminding us about libel laws and how to conduct ourselves. And one of the key things I said was that if you're going to say something nasty or, you know, pretty, you know, horrible about somebody, you need to actually give some evidence. Like, it doesn't have to be a huge amount of evidence, but you have to give something so the reader can look at that and say, well, is that legitimate?
And ideally, give the person right to reply.
Oh yeah, well that's long gone.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm accused of all sorts, and I don't get a right to reply. This is something, because they've got the word, they've got the sentence. You said these words, and it's as you said earlier.
Yeah,
you
don't we have snipped them out.
Or correct or
yeah. And so, I said, well, so like, you would have thought that, you know, in all that stuff that I've done. And you want to call me a far-right writer, and you think that's what I am. You must have been able to find something in all of that to justify what you've said. So you couldn't. But like I said, shouldn't you then maybe, I don't know, tell people where they can find my, you know, gas chambers from which I'm conducting my far-right writing business? You know, like,
yeah,
like this is just nonsense. At best, it's absolute scummery. And these are paid liars. And yet, so there's nowhere you can go in the mainstream. Like, you have, when you're on the fringe, I mean, I walk around Dublin or South Dublin where I live, and or down the west and in various places. And I kind of walk around as if nothing's happened. But I know it has. I know that the people that are looking at me, because they know me, I'm recognizable. They have that sort of, they are convinced that what they hear on RTE, the national broadcaster, or read in the Irish Times, for which I used to sadly work many years, that these things are true in some sense, because otherwise they wouldn't write that, would they? And there's nowhere you can go to have that rectified. You know, and...
we've got the press ombudsman in Britain, but it's useless.
That's part of the system.
I could give an example, but it's too involved to go into. But I complained. They said, "Oh, well, here's the evidence," and it was a completely ridiculous. I don't want to bring my stuff into it because it's too tangential and involved. But my point is, it works on the same principles. You know, one statement out of context, distorted, doesn't matter. You said it. You're screwed.
That's you. That's you. Everything you are is condensed into that little capsule of
exactly.
Words.
It doesn't matter if you've said 100 other things that contradict that or put that in context. Well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's the whole of you. That's that nasty thing is all there is to you.
And yeah.
I find this, it's like witch hunting.
It is, yeah. And that whole thing, I mean, you see, the whole point of, I keep saying this, that the point of public conversation such as what we're having now is not so that I can simply spit out, you know, a series of assertions. I'm having a conversation with you. And if I say something that you don't agree with, you're probably going to pick me up and say, well, you know, and or if I, you say something, if I make a mistake, an error, and say, you know, say, no, that you're not, that's incorrect, the date is wrong, or whatever. This is the purpose of conversation. This is no longer admissible in public trial, at public trial now, in the High Court of Media. That you're not allowed to say, well, we're having a conversation, and I'm speaking off the top of my head and loosely and, you know, without notes and, you know, and I'm exploring issues. I'm not
exactly speaking. And that's the whole point of conversation, is that you say things that you don't necessarily mean sometimes, because yeah, you're exploring the idea in real time.
Yes.
And if you don't have that freedom, then you have what is called the chilling effect, where you don't even enter certain areas because you know you might say, if you go there, you might say something inadvertently that could ruin your career or your life.
Or your life.
So you, exactly, best just not even to think about these things.
Well, that's
how discourse becomes retarded.
That's what most people do now. I mean, I was on a train last night, a DART train into Dublin, briefly, and you know, the carriage was half full. But I saw opposite me, there was a match on in town, a rugby match, but I don't really have much interest in that. But there was two guys opposite. I was fascinated by them. I was watching them because I've only one ear, as I told you, I think, and earlier before we went on, I'm deaf in one ear, so I kind of have to listen. If I want to hear, I have to turn toward my good ear towards them. I was watching these, but I was watching them for a while, and there were two, you know, middle-aged men intently discussing something. And like, in a way that I thought, these are great scientists, and they're talking about some new discovery they've made. Or their lawyers debating the intricacies of some recent case. I could see the intent, the expressions on their face, and I moved closer to hear, just over here, it was just a snatch, see what is it they're talking about, and it was rugby, you know, that was all of their energy, everything of them was going into this discussion about rugby, a rugby match, about some guy that was, you know, scored a try in the last game, but he was back on today, but he I don't know what, you know, I don't care. This is where all of the energy of our people is now going, into trivialities, into frivolity, into nonsense.
I saw someone making this point the other day, that it's the same energy that was always there, but now it's being directed into mundane nonsense like that, because they know they can't care about anything else. They're not allowed to. It's too dangerous.
Too dangerous.
They could ruin their life by caring about some other topic, like, you know, yeah, our population being replaced.
And that's one of the lessons I've learned in the last 6 years, Colin, that, you know, because in the beginning I was very judgmental of people like that. Now I quite understand, you know, I don't blame them in a way. Why would you want to give up your life? You know, if the chances of winning this are so slim, as we know they must be, you know, we're up against like a formidable enemy. Monolithic enemy. This has never happened before in history, you know, that you know, no matter where you look for tyrannies of the past, you know, Stalin's Russia, Mao's China, you know, Ceausescu's Romania, whatever, always there was one critical factor. There was always some agency outside which was prepared to look in with a steely gaze and question what was happening and raise the possibility and the hope that this could be overturned. Now, there is no such phenomenon. There's nothing. There's no force outside that we know of, other than aliens, maybe, are watching. I hope they are. I hope they're good guys, you know, but I don't think so, to be honest. You know?
Yeah, it's a situation where, as you say, you hope that there's someone who will come to the rescue, because we don't know how far this can go and how far it can, you know, regarding that pressure. and the sort of pragmatic decision to just look the other way. I've got a normie relative who really is angry with me for everything I've done. Because, for obvious reasons. And his attitude is, you know, I said to him, well, what about the girls in Rotherham? I mean, and his attitude back then was, why do you care? It's hundreds of miles away.
Yeah.
And now there's an asylum hotel 7 miles away from his house.
Hmm. Yes.
His attitude is still, look, you broke the rules. So what did you expect? That was it. It was, what did you expect? You must have known that you couldn't win this. Therefore, it was stupid to do it because all you've done is bring bad consequences on yourself and other people. So it was the futility of it which angered him, because he thought, he's very pragmatic. You know, he's saying, well, yeah, maybe this does matter, but you can't do anything about it. So, and by trying to do something about it, you're only endangering yourself and other people.
And tell me, do you ever, in your heart, sometimes in your quiet moments, maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, you wake up and you think, why am I banging my head on every brick wall I see? Do you know what I mean? I feel that. I feel that sometimes.
I've always been like that. You know, I was always looking for the rare thing, the special thing, the forbidden thing. It was my nature. So that doesn't bother me. I understand why I do that. That's my nature. What does bring me doubt is I sometimes think you could have had a much easier life. You could have just. I wrote this in the essay this year about my mum, because she suffered because of this, because of what I've done, and of course I feel intense guilt about that. I don't even know how guilty to feel about it, because it's possible that it accelerated her dementia, and if that's true, I don't know if it is true, but if it is true, how guilty can I feel about, like, is it possible to feel guilty enough for doing something like that to your own mother?
That's an interesting question. My mother, in a certain sense, but she died before this. She died in 2012, so she died before this period. Now, she did go through a lot of other lesser, involvements of mine in various public things, and yeah, you know, I know it hurted her a lot. It hurt her a lot to see me attacked and so on. And she had a great phrase that she would say whenever I'd be getting heated in her presence about something, you know, and she'd see the signs of something else starting, you know, she would say, "Ah, don't be annoying yourself," you know,
that's a sort of working class wisdom that actually is valid, because it gets back to what I was saying. Why punish yourself? Why, if you can't win this, then what's the point?
Okay. Well, what then is it, Colin? Because I have this sense, the way I describe this is, I don't have a choice, really. Now, I have to have a choice in one sense, and I come back to that. But I ask me to explain what I mean by that, because I give myself a choice, but it isn't a real choice. The choice is something I give myself merely to have the freedom to do what I have to do. Because if I felt compelled to do it, that wouldn't be healthy, and it would probably make me ill much more quickly than it is making me ill, which it is anyway. But I feel the knuckle of my ancestors in my back. Whenever I hesitate, I feel them. Go on. Come on. Go. Do it. Now. And I know what that is. It's my old upbringing, the nature of my upbringing, the nature of my history, my understanding of my family's history, the understanding of my country's history. There's too much damage been done to our, to my people for me to simply go to a rugby match and talk shite about it afterwards?
Yeah, I agree. And that's what I take solace in as well. It's like, if my people are anything, then surely they fight for their own existence. And therefore it has to be worth it. Because I know that they would have. I know that prior to this age, if you could go to my great grandparents and all the generations before them, they would have been absolutely outraged. Even my grandparents, you know, they died just before, well, the last of them died just before the Rotherham revelations came out. And I often think, what the hell would she have made of this? You know, so that my point is that all of them would have been outraged by what's been done to our countries.
Well,
and
you see,
so that, yeah. And so therefore I am right to be outraged by it, regardless of what the intervening generations say.
And to come at this from a different angle, if you think about, what would we call it, the rhetoric of a moment, the rhetoric of an era, of an age, and we've lived, you've rather fewer decades than I have, but I look back at each one of those decades, going back and remember back to the 60s. I was born in the mid-50s, so I have 70 this year. So I can go back, teleport myself into the 60s and feel the atmosphere. I can do the same for the 70s. I can do the same for the 80s. I can do that for the 90s, and I can do it for the noughties. Now, that's as far as I'd go, because those 5 decades, I would say, what you're talking about, say the Rotherham thing, in no earthly way would that kind of have been conceivable to the British people as a possibility. And if it had, if there was the slightest inkling, there would be an absolute uprising of outrage and resistance against it. I think I feel safe in saying that. But there's also other issues, other things that have arisen now that are like, would have been impossible in any of those decades, because people would have risen up and said, if you think, say, like when the Birmingham Six thing happened, the Guildford Four thing happened, people started to agitate. There were fantastic lawyers who took their sides and took their cases and fought the corrupt judiciary and so on. Now things happen and they're clearly unjust. Clearly wrong, clearly absolutely like criminal. And there's just that silence we've talked about, the mutism. There's a case in Ireland that's been going on now for over 3 years, a young teacher called Enoch Burke, who was a born-again Christian. And he actually was suspended first, and I think essentially fired, but he's still fighting that from his job as a teacher. Because for the precisely the reason that Jordan Peterson became famous, which is that he refused to call a student they, a boy claiming to be a girl, or having a claim made on his behalf, as I now understand it to be, because it's not clear that either the boy or his parents was the one driving this agenda in the first place. It appears very much to be the school itself. And Enoch Burke refused to call this boy they. And he was suspended. And this was gone through all the court system in Ireland. And he spent over 500 days in jail now, overall, for what is called contempt of court. But the basis of his contempt of court, so-called, is the contemptible behaviour of the courts, which have lied and lied and lied about what the case is about. They've denied that the reason that he's in this situation is because he refused to address the boy by the they pronoun. They say, oh, it's because of the manner of his response to it, which they're implying was in some way violent or something like that. It wasn't. There's no evidence of that. And there's all kinds of lies being told about by judges. And the judges are now so deep in their own lies that they have to keep digging. Except one judge, one finding in this court, in the Court of Appeal, just totally against the run of play, and the old pattern has reasserted itself since. But briefly, this woman actually acknowledged, this female judge acknowledged that the real cause of this situation was that Enoch Burke had been ordered to say something he didn't believe in, and that as a Christian, this is his way he puts it, is that as a Christian, he cannot agree to this. And you know, I believe the reason he's emphasizing that so strongly is not particularly, you know, a particularly theological point. He's doing it because the Irish Constitution expressly allows, defends, protects religious freedom. And I think that's a wise enough strategy, I think. But I'm this is me interpreting his motivations, and that's probably not correct of me to do so. But however, that broadly is what it is. Now, what I would say is that in Ireland, in 1960s, in a million years, this could not happen. The people responsible would be unable to walk down the streets. They would be in such disgrace in the public realm. Similarly, the politicians, I mean, the journalists who are defending the lies that they're telling and repeating them, the judges who are telling other lies and further lies and repeating the lies of politicians and the lies of journal liars and so on, none of these people would be tolerated in the civilized society of those years, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, not even in the noughties, up to, say, the 2008, 2009, 2010. Maybe in the last decade, the decade before this, and in this decade, we're in a different world, a different realm, a different logic, a different planet, where we've regressed, we've gone backwards before the advances of enlightenment and understanding and education and freedom and all of those things which everybody was vaunting and talking about and play, you know. And what astonishes me is that I won't mention names because maybe the names I've mentioned wouldn't be all that meaningful to people, your general audience. But I'm talking here about high profile commentators. I'm talking about intellectuals, so called. I'm talking about, you know, journalists, well respected columnists, etc., who are known to have, you know, highly principled views about freedom, justice, all these things. And they're all either silent or attacking Enoch Burke. And I think, I don't know, I lie awake at night trying to figure out what is this about? How can you hold to certain principles for 30, 40, 50 years and then abandon them overnight and take the other side of the argument?
Yeah, and this is why it's not actually true. When people say culture has been in stasis since the year 2000 or since maybe 2005, people often say that. And it's true in one sense that there are no new music genres, there are no new graphic design aesthetics and so forth. That's absolutely right. But in another way, our culture has transformed radically since 2000. Mm. You know, I sometimes have nostalgia for, I was doing a job in London in 2005, and I remember just the atmosphere at that time. And I think that was just before all of this insanity started. And it's not that, I believe me, I don't think that the world was terrific in 2005. Far from it.
No.
But the point is that there's some sort of quantum leap has been taken from that relative sanity to where we are now.
Yeah.
There's a profound difference. Culture really has changed in so many ways since 2000.
But here's the thing, like, that if you think about the methods by which, or the modes by which the society informs us from childhood about what it stands for, and education to media, to cinema, to all these things, those things have, over the course of those decades, will have inculcated in us a deep sense of what's real. It's like, you know, there's no lights in the room, but you can feel, you know, where the furniture is because you've been through it thousands of times. So you know where the furniture of the ethical furniture is. You know where the kind of justice furniture is. You know where all, and you have an instinctive almost sense of what the response of the society will be to any given thing, and as a consequence of that, what the judicial responses will be, what the media responses will be, and so on. That's no longer reliable. You know, you can't any longer simply think, what I've done here is not wrong. It's not criminal. It was done in with the best of intentions. It was, you know, I did no harm to anybody. It didn't harm anybody, as in Enoch Burke's case. That's no longer a defense. You can't find anybody to uphold those principles anymore. You go in and knock on a counter. One time you could knock on, if you were being bullied, say in school or in the town, you could go up to the headmaster, or you could go to the cops and say, listen, you know, you knock on the counter and you know, they will hear your thing, and you kind of can anticipate what the response will be, unless they're completely corrupt. And that did happen to me too. And I agree with you in principle about the past is not perfect. But at the same time, those kind of intuitions were broadly reliable overall. Nothing is reliable now. You don't know. I mean, you could be arrested for anything now. And nobody, there would be no outrage expressed in the press about it, no matter what it was. You know, you wouldn't find any support.
They'd like it.
Yeah.
They'd say, well, he's finally got his comeuppance. I mean,
I won't go into it in detail, but I was in a court case not too long ago in which I was being really, you know, rolled over. And the other side, for the duration of the significant evidence being put by the other side, the media in totality closed down. They put down their pencils and they waited for 3 days before they picked them up again. Like, this is mind-boggling stuff. It seems impossible that this could happen in a modern society. This is like Banana Republic stuff. But that's where we've got to.
Yeah, in all sorts of ways. This is the where you realize that dysfunction and corruption have now been baked. I mean, I had a guest on last night, Michael Rayners, and everyone should watch that stream. And he went over this, the law, the constitutional changes that have been made. And so the result of it is that, as you say, things just don't work as you expect them to, and as you could have once expected them to work.
Yeah.
There are now things just don't happen, or something else intervenes.
Or you expect a particular group or sector to rise up and say, no, this is wrong. Like, for example, in COVID, we accept the civil libertarian organizations to be screaming to high heaven. They weren't. They were telling people, shut up and listen to the government. You would expect, you know, that if an issue is, for example, was pro-life, for example, that if somebody was being attacked under that heading, that they would have solidarity, at least, from that sector. No. None. Not a word. You know, it's a deafening silence. Yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. You used to know, it was a sort of cliche. You said, well, obviously that crowd will stand up for her in this situation. Mm-hmm. And now, no, she's on her own. She's on her own against this huge judiciary and the media backing it up.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. The politicians agreeing with the media and saying the right thing for the press conference about that case.
Yeah.
And so forth. And so, but the thing is, the scary thing is that for a child growing up now, it will be as it was for you growing up in the 60s, where it's a whole new furniture. And just as you became aware of that and ended up with an intuitive grasp of how your society was, it will be the same for a child today. They'll grow up and they'll intuitively know that, well, if you do that, then the entire Irish society will come down on you.
Hmm.
So it's a new normal that has been manufactured artificially over the last 20 years or so.
Or even, and that counts also if you're actually being accused in the wrong, as Enoch Burke is being accused and imprisoned in the wrong. I mean, you know, where are the kinds of people that stood up and marched for the Birmingham 6, for the Guildford 4? And they did. I remembered, and write long articles in the papers. I did, and as an editor, and spoke to Gareth Pearce, the lawyer working for them. And, you know, we were absolutely intent upon getting them released, not just in Britain, but on Ireland, in these islands, totally. And eventually, both cases, despite the reluctance of the and the corruption of the judiciary and everything, they did happen in the end. But now there is no hope of it happening. The judges know that all they have to do is shout the lies louder, and they will win.
So, dare I ask, what do you now make of Elon Musk? In spite of, let's just ignore Twitter. You don't like Twitter. Fine.
Yeah.
I understand why. But do you not think, because you were talking earlier about an outside force swooping in to intervene and help people. He hasn't done that directly yet, as far as I know. He hasn't, or maybe he has funded some court cases. I don't know, but he's certainly talked about doing that. But he did bring attention, for example, to the Muslim grooming, the Pakistani grooming stuff at the start of this year, which really did embarrass the British government. I mean, I think, I don't think that's an illusion. I think that they were screwed by that. They just didn't know how to react. And again, I'm not hero worshipping Elon Musk. I'm not saying he's tremendous, and I'm not even saying he's on our side or whatever. I think he's kind of naive. He's artistic, you know, but I think he does understand that something is seriously amiss, because it keeps coming up and he keeps responding to it with tweets saying, wow, big if true, this is outrageous, and so on. So it's almost like he's a sort of child new to the world, and he's seeing all this stuff that just doesn't make sense. And I don't know. So you take.
Yeah, well, I wrote an article in First Things magazine good 4 years ago, I think, about Elon Musk. And the headline that I chose for it, although this didn't actually appear on the article as published, was Hero on a Zebra. And the idea was that it's not easy to say if the horse under Elon Musk is a white charger or a very dark animal. So it's kind of either a white horse with black stripes or a black horse with white stripes. In other words, it's a zebra, and it's ambiguous. And that's how I feel about him. I mean, I spend a lot of time studying him and reading about him and watching him. And he really impresses me with what reads as sincerity. I have to say that. And also, he's extraordinarily charismatic. And articulate. Now, he's not actually all that articulate, but somehow he is. You know what I mean? He doesn't speak.
It's that sort of autistic brevity, which really makes a point.
Yes, it does. Exactly right. Now, the on the other side of the line, there's you know, first of all, the very stark, clear stuff, which is that he's involved in surveillance of satellites. He's involved in brain chipping, Neuralink, and all that stuff, and driverless cars, and all that stuff. And okay, now I'm not making any definitive judgment on that. You know that can go multiple ways. But you know, I just have a sense sometimes that, you know, like he says all the things I want to hear. You know, the things he says, I want to hear them all. I agree. I think if I knew him, we would be friends. I would be friends with him. We would talk and we would get on, and I would support him to the hilt. I feel that in some part of me. There's another part of me that worries because of the other stuff, the Neuralink and the stuff partly, but also because of, you know, the Twitter stuff. Like, you know, he came into Twitter and he did New Broom and all that, but it didn't make any difference to Twitter Ireland. It's still a shit tip, you know? And you can't express, I was just sat upon. I should have far more viewers than, or whatever, followers than I have, and I don't. And I won't ever get them, it seems, on the model of Twitter that exists. So I think he either neglected the Irish office, didn't come here, didn't try to shake it up, or else he's happy enough with what's going on there. And I don't know what the answer to that is. But What I would say is this, is that the concern I have, not just about Elon Musk, but about Donald Trump now increasingly, and the entire White House thing, and J.D. Vance and all these guys, and there's so many ambiguities, you know, with this tech bro connection and Palantir and you know, all this stuff, you know, it's very, very worrying, and especially the way that those guys were brought into the White House on day one of the second Trump presidency. I had a book out this year. I'm not plugging it, but it's called The Abolition of Reality. But I genuinely want to make this point because it's in it. I've described what I fear in this more or less form. It's like we're in a movie, and the movie we're in now, it enter into Act Three, and in the first act, second act, we had the villains are winning, and the villain were characters. You know, Bond villains like caricature, like Klaus Schwab, these guys, the evil monsters, you know, sitting in the dark room, you know, stroking their cats, whatever. Then we thought, you know, we have to defeat these. And then, then in the second, the third act, suddenly there was the hooves could be heard of the horses coming up the far side of the hill. Drup, 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 drup. And there was Donald, and there was Elon, and there was kind of JD, you know, and they're coming to town to sort things out, you know. And I kind of think, oh, that's great. Yeah. And I like what everything they say. I like the look of them. I like the cut to their jibs. But then I have this fear that, you know, what's going to happen is, that, you know, oh, we're going to defeat Klaus Schwab and all that. And we have. And, you know, maybe even, what do you call that other asshole? BlackRock.
Him. I thought you meant Yuval Noah Harari.
Oh, there
he is. Sort of faded away, thank God.
Yeah.
BlackRock guy, yeah, I know who you mean.
Larry Fink. If anything, he's worse. He's the worst of them all. Anyway. But these guys are routed and they're driven out of town, right? And then we all sit around the campfire, you know, Elon's there and Donald is there and JD's there and all that. And then, you know, we all drink to the success of, and Elon then says, you know, well, what are we going to do next, boys, you know? And Elon says, what about if we just start chipping everybody's brains and you know, start kind of creating the central bank digital currencies and, you know, really get more efficient, you know, and everybody goes, yeah, we won, so yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah. How about we level old Dublin and build a steel-plated roller coaster or something, a maglev train?
Let's do it. This is my fear. Yeah. You know, and that the movie is, you know, you're sitting in the audio in the theater watching this movie, and your heart is flowing over with joy at this outcome. But it's the same outcome as would have happened with the bad guys.
Yeah, it's difficult to work out what is going on there, because, as you say, there's clearly some sort of disagreement or difference of mind between him and Klaus Schwab, between Elon Musk and Klaus Schwab.
Yeah.
But there's commonality as well, and it seems to rest on technological efficiency, which means surveillance of the populace and control of them, to some extent. But I think Elon Musk believes that there won't need to be great control, because the free market means that people will just make the same choices over and over again.
Yeah, but what if this was written as a movie script, that these characters, we were back to that word again, characters, Klaus Schwab, bad, you know, evil, laughing, Elon Musk, you know, naive, you know, gormless in some sense, you know, likable, you know, kind of guy.
Big ideas.
Kind of guy you'd love to drive across America with, you know, in an open-topped car and in a Chevrolet or something like, and you'd have a fantastic time laughing your head off, you know, you really would. But maybe he's just Klaus Schwab with, you know, better hair.
Yeah, and a bit more charisma. Yeah, I agree. There's that. There's always that danger because, as you say, he seems like a nice guy and friendly, and he'd be a good conversationalist. You could have a laugh with him, and you could have a drink with him, and all that. I agree. I feel the same way, and yet there's also this sense, but he's kind of like a child.
Yeah,
and that's very dangerous for a child to have enormous power. It is very dangerous, and we know that he's in with. Certain interests that don't seem to have. I mean, there's the control and surveillance and all that stuff, but there's also another side of it, which is, as suggested by my steel-plated roller coaster stuff. Does he actually understand what the things that you and I understand, that what makes a people, what makes a place? It's not just efficiency.
I don't think he does.
Technological. You know, there's a sense, there's got to be a soul, there's got to be truth, there's got to be history.
Yeah.
Would he just level all of this stuff, all of these old buildings? You know, because I always think this is a significant. What's someone's attitude to old buildings? It's like you can judge someone by how they treat the old, or how they treat kids, or how they treat animals. You know, I think you can judge them by what they do with old buildings. I think it says a hell of a lot.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, Elon Musk, I don't know, like, for example, whenever he always says the right thing, as I say. And when he says talks about Ireland, which I know intimately as an issue, as a question, as a whatever, as a phenomenon, the Irish problem, he says things that I would agree with. But he doesn't ever reveal a real depth of understanding of the nature of the thing. It's always second, third hand material that he's spun.
Superficial.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, and then put that together with his inaction on Twitter Ireland, which is a really shit tip, as I say. It really is the most censorious thing. And this brings me to what I think is the most kind of. See, I think we're in danger of going into a very, very dark, much darker place than we actually even imagined. One of the things I would say, Colin, about what's going on is, over the last few years, is the chink of light that was there all the time was that whereas we were being in danger of being suppressed and oppressed by technology, by internet technique, tech and all the rest of it, social media and all that, surveillance, all that. Smartphones, that we had our own corner of that we could use to strike back, what we're doing now, right? This is our, you know, that this is the kind of mitigating kind of aspect of the internet in this context. And, you know, I'd love to think that that's true. And I kind of think also, I think that actually, if you talk about the resistance, I think in Ireland, certainly, I can't speak for other countries so much, but the resistance in Ireland started off very thin, then it became stronger and it looked quite promising for a while. Now the resistance is the successful part, the working parts of it are really just people who do this kind of thing, who are communicating in an attempt to raise the consciousness of their people, you know. But I have a feeling that, you know, what if that is taken away from us? That capacity to speak back to power, to abuses of power. And I think this is a real danger now. And the reason I say that is because I'm on Substack, and Substack was launched as a free speech platform. And in the early stages, I've been on it for 5 years now. It's a really great platform, and really, I never had an issue with
anything. You're an early starter. You know, I've only been on there for two and a half years. But, so well done.
Well, I've tell you something. I don't know if you picked this one up, Colin, but, you know, I've had the last year very kind of strange feelings about Substack. Something's changed. It's not the same. And I see mention of this in other Substackers as well. They're beginning to say, what's going on? They feel that they're being capped, you know, that there's only so far that they can go, that there's a kind of a ceiling over their growth. And I feel that. I mean, when I joined first, I could get, you know, treated over in America and get huge numbers of hits for a particular article if it went down a particular channel. And there were other signs as well, you know. But in the last year, I find it's like, you know, whereas my subscribers overall are increasing, my paid subscribers are plummeting. And there's something, I don't know what that is, but it's something not quite right. But now, in the last couple of weeks, something very weird has happened. And that is that I found out that in the UK, several of my posts have been blocked on the basis that that age-related content, they're marked. And the people have to actually provide ID in order to get in and read them, even though they're already subscribers. Photographic ID and so on. And this is allegedly done. I thought this was for, you know, the Starmer Stasis, you know, but it's not. It's actually Substack acting on behalf of Starmer Stasis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I tried to...
Well, actually, just one thing. It's actually, this legislation was written under the Conservatives. So it's not the Starmer government that wrote it.
Oh, no, but they're implementing it with great relish now. And what's actually transpiring here is that even though there are certain criteria that this is the Online Safety Act, which relates to things like pornography, towards, you know, threats of violence, issues like suicide, self-harm, those kind of sensitive issues, and that these under these headings you can be prone to some form of restriction of access to your material. Now, none of these criteria apply to the articles that I know that have been blocked, but that I've been told by some subscribers or readers have been blocked. But here's the really interesting thing. When I tried in, there used to be a thing called Substack support, and you just simply sent an email of your query and you got, you know, reasonably good, not always satisfactory, but reasonably good feedback from person to person, human. Now, last week, I've tried to bring up this on that channel and found that it was gone. And they sent me instead a link to a chat line with an AI who, then the AI simply filibusters and stalls and says,
it's arse from its elbow.
Yeah, and just repeats the same thing over and over again. So clearly, Substack is hiding behind this now. Now, this is a very dismaying situation. Because Substack was genuinely a free speech platform, and I believe now that it has fallen, not just to the tyranny of the laws, the British new censorious laws, but actually to pragmatism, which probably comes from investors. I won't go into it, but there are certain investors who in Substack who would not be, you know, on my Christmas card list. And so we're now looking at the in this context, the hope we had that there were certain people, certain entities going to hold the line, that's looking a little less certain now, you know, because Substack really were.
I agree that I really like Substack, and I'm more optimistic about it than you are, apparently. I agree. When I first found it, I realized that there's a certain process to publishing, for example. It doesn't happen instantaneously. It's sort of the system sort of waits, it staggers it, which makes it feel like a process. It makes it feel like something real is happening, something meaningful is happening. And that's been programmed into it. There's no need for that. It could just happen instantaneously. But they make it feel like something is real, something's happening. And that's part of why I liked and still like the platform.
Sorry, Carl, I don't quite follow that point. What is the nature of the process?
Well, I just mean that it's artificially slowing down. Like when you press to publish something, it will ask, it will do the time thing as if it's working, as if something is happening in the background and you're having to wait.
Oh, yeah,
That could just happen instantaneously, but instead they make it feel like a sort of official publishing event is going on. And that's part of this attitude that is shown in the platform throughout of wanting seriousness and quality. It's not slop.
Yes.
That's just one example of it that I'm using there, just as to illustrate. And that's why I like it. It's one of the reasons I like it. And they were certainly very free speech, and I think they remain, I think that's still the case. But they have to do this stuff in order to comply with British law.
But the thing is, you see, I understand if something is called the Online Safety Act and it's passed and it's the law and it relates to, you know, pornography or, you know, whatever, you know, grooming, all this kind of stuff. Sure, I'm all with that. I have no issue. But if a free speech platform is allowing that to be used to censor material, like one of the articles that was censored was about that precise case I mentioned, the Enoch Burke case. Now, there's nothing in that case, in that article, which could be remotely connected to any principle as that I know of that is articulated in that, or that I've seen, that has any relevance to that act. And Substack must know that. And they are, instead of actually facing and coming and talking to me about this, they're putting me on to an AI who's going to wear me down and drive me into, you know, just saying, ah, solid, I won't bother. You know, and I find that really reprehensible. And
yeah, I agree.
And this
use of AI stuff is just terrible. Like a year or a year and a half ago, I tried, maybe less than that, I tried to apply to get my old PayPal account back, my proper PayPal account, which I was banned from in 2018. And so I ended up in this conversation with an AI bot, which could do nothing and tell me nothing. And it just went round in circles. Mm. And it's like, God, is this a vision of the future? Is this just what it's going to be like, where you're endlessly conversing with a yes. thing that doesn't even know it's going around in circles, and it can just repeat the same bullshit 1,000 times over, a million
That's right.
times over.
That's right. I mean, the other thing about this point is that it seems to kind of gel or to somehow resonate with some other fears that I had, and some of them are kind of, I didn't have them initially, but when I listened to other people in Substackers, you know, they would raise questions. Like one particular Substacker has consistently been talking about this and somewhat skeptical, but more and more I said, is this possible? Because the argument was that it seems now that Substack is almost like a holding area for dangerous voices, and that they're contained and they're kind of, you know, they have enough to get by on, but they're not going to go anywhere, really. They're not going to suddenly break out and do any serious damage.
This gets us to a beef that I do have with Elon Musk. I don't know if you know this, but Substack introduced a minor feature. I've forgotten what it was even called. Notes.
Notes,
and
yeah.
He said that not only did it kind of replicate the functionality of Twitter, which I don't think it does, no, it's never going to replace Twitter. It's ridiculous for him to say that they were trying to.
Yeah, it is. Nonsense.
Never going to happen. But he said also that they stole code from Twitter in order to build the notes feature. Maybe that's true. But either way, his response to this was to thwart links from Twitter to Substack. Hmm. So if you're trying to advertise your article, your new essay on there, I'm going to use the word SE because that's what I think of my work as, and I'm pretty sure you're exactly the same. I take it seriously.
Hmm. Yeah,
these are proper pieces of work that I do on there. If you're trying to advertise your essay on Twitter, it will get throttled and it won't show a preview of the page either. It just
I take that point. I think that is true. I will say this also, though. Yeah, sorry. I'll say this also. I don't like notes. I don't do anything. I can't be bothered with that kind of stuff. I don't want to get messages from people who, whatever, want to start an argument about something I said. But my thing is this: I think that's a dilution. That's another dilution of the original kind of manifesto of Substack, which was to present serious.
Yeah,
material.
I don't think the notes thing has added anything to that. I mean, I've used it once or twice just to give people quick updates. But, you know, I've got Twitter and Telegram for that. I don't need Substack to do that. So I agree. And there is that risk when it happens inside the platform that it dilutes the purpose of the platform. I agree with you on that. But I'm just annoyed with Elon Musk because I'm convinced that actually started literally weeks after I started on Substack. He did that. And so I suddenly couldn't advertise my stuff on there. Now, I still do, but it doesn't get anywhere near the reach that it would get.
No.
So yeah, well, my Substack has been throttled from a few weeks in by this stupid decision by Elon Musk. It's had real-world consequences, not just for the Substack platform upon whom he was presumably taking revenge, but upon all those people who are trying to make a fucking living.
And which is counter to free speech, which is the thing he claims most claims to champion. Like, I agree entirely. I mean, it is. And that's another example of the ambiguity of Musk. Like, you know, that, you know, you just wonder, is this guy who he seems to be and who does he seem to be anyway? You know, that's kind of what I feel about him. See, and again, why liking him in the sense you can like somebody you don't know. I do like him, as it were.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of wary of him.
See, he's trying to do the inverse with Twitter, where you can now do fully, like, you can do long, like an essay length post on Twitter now, articles with formatting, HTML formatting and all that, which is cool, but it's never going to, like, people are never going to go to Twitter for that, because for the same reason they're not going to go to Substack for the notes feature.
Exactly.
That's not how it works.
Why can't they just each do what they're good at, and then we have two functional and useful platforms which are complementary and helpful to each other. I don't see the problem.
Yeah.
Why?
I agree. People like to have a domain that's for a specific thing. I mean domain in the figurative sense. They want to have I go there to do this. I go there to do this. Mm. And it's separate, and that's fine.
Oh,
we don't need everything to be under one roof. And that's what he wants with X. He wants it to be the everything app, he said. Yeah. And I think that's...
Yeah, I agree. Like, Substack was an amazing invention. You know, to think that, you know, they set up the whole structure of, you know, how to publishing and presenting and design and you know, even marketing and all this, everything and monetization and all these things. And it's all painless. It's all easy. And all you have to do then is you just sit and you write your articles and you learn how to do it yourself. I could do it now. It took me a couple of weeks to learn it, but I can do it. And it's a fabulous, I mean, it's the salvation of journalism potentially, but they don't seem to be determined or either they don't seem to understand what they're up against. Or at least if they are, then they're determined. They don't seem determined to take it on, really. And that worries me. I think, you know, they should be howling to the four winds about what's been done to them, to their reader, to their writers and their readers in this context of the public, the whatever that awful act is, Public Safety Act or whatever they call it. Because that's the tail end. It's not a particularly ten end, but it is the beginning of a much bigger closing down of opinion and discussion. And, you know, if now that they see they can do it, they're going to do it again and better.
Yeah, that's the danger, that it's just going to keep whittling down the options and the freedom of reach and the freedom of speech. But I don't know. I think the other aspect of Substack is the use of AI, and that keeps coming up. Actually, in StreamYard as well, the platform that we're using now, they've just introduced AI stuff, which I haven't used, and I'm not really interested in using it. Same with Substack. I just want to write. That's all I want to do.
I know. I never tried to find out anything about what Substack or any of their innovations. I'm not interested in their innovations. What they had is perfect.
It's a similar thing with Patreon back in the day, and I got banned from Patreon, so this is no longer relevant to me. But still, Patreon was a fantastic idea. Fantastic idea. You could set up, people could say, they could set a price that they would donate for each thing that you made that month, for each month, and there would be a total that they would donate each month. So what that meant was it incentivized you to make quite a few videos, but it didn't result in people losing a fortune. So if they said that they would pay £10 per video and you made 50 videos, they wouldn't have to pay £500 because it would be capped at, say, £50 or whatever. So everyone got, it was a really fair system that worked to incentivize you to make stuff.
Productivity,
and
yeah.
You for it. Exactly. But didn't result in unfairness. Brilliant, brilliant idea. They didn't need to change a damn thing about it. But I think they'd employed staff to come up with new ideas to improve the platform.
And was so, a mistake.
Yeah, it was, because there was no need for it. And all of these new, every new innovation, every new thing they added, I thought, we don't need that. I have no idea. You're just making it more complicated. So what's the point? But the point is, you've got to justify having employed these people.
Yeah, and the people you employ have to justify their existence. Yeah, so you have to come up with some mad idea because they've been asked to. And I think this is really true of all tech, I think. You know, I think that the mobile phone was kind of perfected maybe around 20 years ago. But they keep adding new things to it, and it gets more and more unwieldy and dysfunctional. You know, and now the modern one is actually much less user-friendly, to my mind, than the ones that I was using 20 years ago.
I just had to get a new phone just immediately before Millennial. It was a load of stressful things happened all at once, and I had to get a new phone finally, and it's my second smartphone. The first one was, I'd had it for eight years, and I dreaded getting a new one because I knew I'd have to set it all up again.
Oh,
I have to say, in the event, it wasn't as bad as I was dreading. It took a day or two to get everything installed and all that. But this is this thing with Substack. I'm still optimistic about it. Because I like it, and it's where I make my living. It's where, throughout the year. Millennial is the last 3 months of each year, but the other 9 months are Substack work. And actually, I continued publishing new essays even during those 3 months while I was working on Millennial. So that's what I do. And so I hope, you know, it's where I make my living, so I hope that it continues. The Online Safety Act, I mean, this is just infuriating because there's the overbearing state, the stuff that we talked about earlier, where they're literally putting you in prison or harassing you or raiding your house or interrogating you at the airport or all the stuff that people like us have endured. But then there's this other side of it, which is that they're just infantilizing everyone by default. So you've got to do the age thing in order to read an essay. I mean, it's absurd. And I'll tell you, it used to be a sort of assumption that gory images, gory video, obscene lyrics, those were the things that got censored. Those were the things that you had to be over 18 to see and hear. But text, there was always an assumption that text is for everyone. I mean, you don't need, like, a 13-year-old can read about the debate on trans, or the debate on immigration, or even the debate on race. It's not like seeing some dreadful, gory horror film. It's not going to mess them up. So therefore, there's no need put it behind an age wall.
But this is a blanket instrument of censorship. It will work on the basis that nobody will be certain what is included or what isn't. And therefore, all these tech people will, because the fines are absolutely gargantuan, you know, and I understand that. It's absolutely horrendous. But again, it's a function of the fact that our culture has basically closed down in these contexts and refuses to actually discuss, isn't permitted to discuss these things. So most people don't even know that how what's happening in these contexts.
Yeah. And as I was talking there, I realized, well, there was a prototype for this idea that speech can be harmful and ideas can be harmful. And that was the university, where lecture theaters throughout the West are now space, especially in America. I think most of all in America, are seen as places that have to be kept safe. because the students have to be kept safe from dangerous ideas, from harmful ideas, from offensive. It's not just about, you know, remember in the old days, offense, I find that offensive, and offenses taken, not given, and all that. It's not just offensiveness now. They don't speak about something being offensive. They speak about it being harmful.
And extremist.
Actively harmful.
Extremist.
And extremist.
And the next word is terrorist. Terrorist. You know, it's absolutely. But again, you know, we go right back to what we were saying there, to those decades, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties. No problem with any of this. It was intelligence. The culture was intelligence. Now it's not. It's stupid. And the stupidity, stupidity seems to be working well for power and for tyranny.
Yeah. I think that it's amazing. Like, I can hardly remember the 90s. And I was 17 when they ended. I struggled to quite remember how were they, how did they differ from the 2000s and so on. But I think I've just about got it. But I can certainly barely remember the 80s. I can only remember how it was, like my immediate sensations and excitements about being a small boy in the 80s.
Sure.
But I think it's amazing to, like, and again, this came up when I was writing the essay about my mother earlier this year. I thought, and then a friend died as well, an older guy. And I had the same thought, which is that all of this is so precious, the stuff that you can remember, and the because you can remember the world when it was different from the way it is today. And that would be the same. It would be valuable even in a better age than ours, but it's especially valuable in an age like ours, because well within living memory, there was a different world from this. There were different ways of ordinary people interacting. There were different givens, different presuppositions in everyday life. And I think that's something that should be recorded. And
it's so important to call. It's so important to have a witness from the past, from various points in the past, and whenever possible, that is kind of able to reference things and to give a color and a complexion to reality as it was then, as opposed to reducing it to slogans and smears, which is often happens with the past. I think that's something we, you know, it's a very important function now, you know, to remember accurately what things felt like. You know, that's the thing that I think we're missing most of all, because we get all this statistical information about the past and all these kind of, dark descriptions of things that happened, whether it was in orphanages or wherever, and it did happen, and that's true. But that doesn't convey the granular nature of reality as it was lived then. And it's unfair.
And the beauty of life in general.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'll read out one little bit from that essay that I wrote. This was talking about social standards. The young today do not know the standards, do not even know that there could be standards. But that means, and no doubt teachers would laugh at the idea, but that means society will be different in future. With mum dies not only an era, but the means to create it. All of this is encoded in a person. They are both a record and a nucleus of their time. And this is why I say to you that it's amazing to think that you can remember the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And I think that don't underestimate that, and don't think that the young won't be interested in hearing about it, because I think especially in this day and age, they will be.
Yeah, well, I've kind of always been accused of being nostalgic, you know, and I'm not really. I mean, I try to kind of remember things accurately. But I have actually, strange you mentioned that, because I have actually in the last few months been really thinking in a renewed way about that. You know, I went back to the house I was born into, you know, recently, and looked at it now, and I have a memory of it, and I want to write about that, and I want to do, you know, I took some photographs of it as it is now. I'm hoping to get some photographs of it as it was. There were none that we knew of, but I believe there are some of it as it was when we disposed of it. And I think I do. I agree with you. That's really important to show something that is, you know, what would you call it? A kind of an animated account of the past, you know, with all the shades, all the colors that you can remember. That's so important, you know, that kind of sense that it's almost like that to chase that kind of Proustian encounter in ways that will actually communicate to people who weren't there. That's a hard one, but it's possible, I think.
All right. I wish we could talk forever because this is so interesting and we're going in all these different directions. But we should do the super chats. I've just realized the next guest is actually Do You Know? So they'll have to wait 10 minutes.
He's in the chamber, yes.
Yes, they'll just have to wait. Sorry, but we've got some super chats and I kind of lost track of time. So interesting was this conversation. Love and Division said, sports ball, this is when you were talking about rugby, sports ball is the opiate of the masses.
Yeah, Chomsky wrote a lot about that there. You know, I don't agree with him about everything, but he was really good on that whole subject years ago. Noam Chomsky, sport as a distraction. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Open Borders asks about Gemma O'Doherty, whether you're still in touch with her.
Not especially, no.
Right, okay. All right. Ghost Dog Man says, people and tribes are under stress like animals. Scapegoating becomes the metaphysical get-out-of-a-jam trick to band-aid over our torn asunder peace. The sacrificial lambs we become for their salvation. Scapegoating becomes a metaphysical get-out-of-a-jam trick. I think that touches on what you were saying earlier, that it's almost like the regime uses people like us demonizes us, scapegoats us, and thus proves that the rest of the society is absolutely fine. If it weren't for these hate mongers, these extremists, these far-right maniacs, then everything would be fine.
That's right. That's why they keep banging that far-right drum. I mean, even though it's completely, in the case of Ireland, and I think of the United Kingdom pretty much, it's complete nonsense. But they keep banging it, and they have every journalist. I actually have this fantasy that I've kind of created, which is that there's a room somewhere in Dublin where clerks sit at tables all the day, and they're going through all the papers, and they're counting the number of times the term far-right appears, and they're paying... They're authorizing payments to journalists on that basis. So they have to cram the term far right into every article. And if they get in twice into the same paragraph, there's a bonus and so on. Because that's how this works, exactly that. That it's really, and it's a projection, of course, because the only fascists on the block are the government who are actually orchestrating all this.
They're the ones who are doing everything that we're seeing, the censorship, the automation of censorship, the deplatforming, the incentivizing to deplatform, the imprisoning, the hate speech charges. It's them. So if that is fascism, I mean, people will use that word to all sorts
loosely,
of things.
Loose sense. Yeah.
You know, if you're looking for a totalitarian tyranny, it's probably the state today.
Yeah. And
not,
it's abuse of
not people
abuse of
who
power.
Have no resources at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's abuse of power, absolutely.
You cannot be the far right, even on this narrow basis alone. This is nonsense. You cannot be the far right if you are powerless. How can you be? You cannot be a fascist if you're powerless. Fascism is power, is a coalition between politics and corporations and business. That's what it is in definitional terms. But of course, it has all these other, you know, it's the methodologies and so on, and its histories and so on. Yes, but none of these things apply to the people they're talking about, because mostly, in fact, almost exclusively, they're just ordinary people saying, I don't like what you're doing to my country.
And think about some regime, like some journalist who's completely on board with fashionable ideas, and they're backing up the establishment, backing up the government, backing up the judiciary. Well, how would a journalist in a fascist regime be behaving any differently from that?
Exactly.
So It's so stupid. But it's embarrassing that we need to say this stuff.
But it's also terrifying that people can be what you would call that. I use the word loosely, but not. I don't mean literally stupid. I mean, I don't mean that they're actually genuinely stupid, but that they could actually act in such a stupid way, as if to say that they have no brains at all, and they don't care. But they know what's happening. They know what they're doing. They know why they're doing it, and they keep doing it. So that's the terrible thing about it. It's terrifying that they will implacably continue with this line until doomsday. Regardless of facts.
Oh, yeah, facts are irrelevant. Okay, armchair Limerick nationalist, hello again, says, Merry Christmas, John and Woes. What does John think the end game of the Enoch Burke issue is? They can hardly lock him up for life, and he won't back down. So what will the state do? Off the cuff, I don't know about this case, but I would say it sounds like the process is the punishment here, and
yes.
Yeah, but anyway, John, what would you say?
Well, I mean, I don't. I almost don't hesitate to utter this, you know. But this isn't just me that believes this or fears this. One of my great fears is that they will end up putting him into a psychiatric hospital or something, and then he will be in there for life. And they, you know, on the face of things, it doesn't seem that there would be a sufficient outcry about that, because there's so much, you know, not alone is there equivocation in the broad realm, the public realm, but there's equivocation on the side that should be four square behind him. There's all kinds of caveats into it, because he's an evangelical Christian and so on, and, you know, the Catholics don't like that, and all this nonsense. Like I say, every time you equivocate about this in any way whatsoever, you're encouraging, you're giving encouragement to the tyrants to continue, because that's where they're getting their energy from.
Yeah, indeed. And that's something that everyone has to remember, has to bear in mind. Okay, Ghost Dog Man. Our cognitively washed normies don't see the irony of worshipping and defending a sports ball team's uniform colour, but lose the plot when it comes to identifying racial and ethnic differences.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the great ironies here for Ireland is, you know, we've had a thing in the last few months about the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, you know, whining about the fact that the Irish flag is being misused by the far right, you know. It's very strange, you know. The last time we really saw the Irish flag in a very prominent way was during the era of Jack Charlton's managership of the Irish soccer team, and you know, everybody thought that was fantastic. You know, like, it's bizarre. I mean, I don't mean that I take this literally, but you know, when I was going to school, like, soccer was regarded as a foreign game, you know. And suddenly, you know, that it became the only place, because of the actions of the Provisional IRA and the associations thereof, pertaining thereto, it became that soccer was the only medium whereby you could fly this flag with a certain sense of impunity. And now, you know, we're into a situation where you can't actually fly the flag in a political context to defend your nation and to ask why the nation is being destroyed in plain sight. You know, but again, these are the conditions we're in. You see, this is the amazing thing about it all is, Colin, that while the things we talk about are all true, but out there in the streets and in the byways, there's almost no consciousness of any of this. There might be a slight kind of tickle of irritation about certain things, but there's no sense that they've turned reality completely inside out. I mean, that's one of the reasons I call my book The Abolition of Reality. It's not the reality we had, it's gone. It's abolished. Yeah.
This is what the normie is like. I almost think that you could place them into a war zone with, you know, explosions going off all around them and armies marching past them and all the rest, and they would just be completely oblivious as long as they had their sports ball. And
yeah.
Yeah, as long as they had what they need, everything else is just irrelevant, just isn't happening. It's not real to them. It's quite remarkable.
Yes, I do. I think, you know, it's remarkable to me, you know, that there are people alive in Ireland now who do not feel that knuckle in their back at any time whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah. And that in itself is so depressing, that people are so cut off from, as you say, their ancestors. Hmm. They don't sense that. They don't have that sense of obligation and duty and a broader story that they are part of. Hmm. That's all been done in. But anyway, well, it hasn't been. Just in some people. It's not,
in,
not
some
in
people,
everyone.
In some people. And not, yeah. not necessarily terminally yet. That's
exactly. Just, yeah. It's very important to remember that. Essex Nomad says, I love listening to John, and this stream is really engaging. What does John think of the ubiquity of SSRIs and antidepressants in Western society? It seems widespread to me, and I've noticed what looks like long-term cognitive decline in the users of these drugs.
Oh, well, I this is one of the issues in which I got into enormous trouble in the past, and that doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, dodge the question at all, but I did. I remember being set up in an interview about 10 years ago where I was asked, in relation to a particular dilemma I was in, a situation, or are you depressed, are you suicidal, you know, and I wanted to get back to the issues at hand, and I said, well, it's all nonsense, you know it's all a cop-out, you know, something like that. But actually what I really meant was that depression is a manufactured construct of psychiatric profession. That's not to say that people aren't going to be sad. They are. I'm very sad sometimes. Despondent, disappointed, you know, downcast, you know, even despairing sometimes. But the idea that it's somehow something that you can actually treat as if it's like a mechanical fault in a motor car is absolute absurdity, you know. And this idea that, you know, I would say that if the truth were told, that these medications that are referred to there, the antidepressants and so on, they're probably at the root of much of the disturbance that we're now talking about. Because what's actually going on is doctors are recommending certain kind of protocols in relation to so-called depression. And if they don't work, they're simply adjusting them or adding to them. And there are people in all kinds of cocktails. And the next thing, they have no autonomy whatsoever mentally. They have no autonomy in terms of the moods. They're dependent on these substances. I think it's an appalling thing. It's, you know, it's extraordinary. You know, I remember that time back then when I got into trouble, and there was a friend of mine. I rang him up and he hadn't heard about it, and I said, "They're really coming after me now," you know. And he says, "Oh, what did you say?" He said, "Well, I said, you know, that, you know, this depression stuff or whatever it is, it's all a racket or something like that." He says, "John, that was a terrible thing to say." He says, "Don't you realize that half the country is on tablets?" You know, and it's so true. It's so true. This is the thing I've felt, you know, sometimes, you know, the way when you actually start thinking about why people behave, and we've been talking about it for the last couple of hours, Colin, in certain ways. And only going down the stairs or, you know, down the road afterwards, you think, oh, I should have mentioned something about this or that. But this is one of the ones that occurs to you, that actually, far from, you don't need necessarily involuted kind of psychological analysis of people. You just say that. They're on tablets. What would you expect?
Yeah.
What would you expect?
It's going to affect their thinking, and it does seem to. I mean, I haven't seen personal evidence of it in my own life, but I've heard enough about this that there are people who are sort of zombified by long term use of antidepressants. I mean, you know, I think depression is real. I've had experience of it for large periods in my 20s and early 30s, but it is something that ultimately results from your real life situation, and
that's the point. That's the point. But it's an organic condition. It's not some kind of weather that blows over and catches you. You know, it's just a word. I mean, I know that people get sad. I know that people, and that sad can continue, that sadness can continue for long periods and can become deeply embedded. But I think of it like as, it's almost like, you know, if you don't defrost your fridge, it just gets clogged up. And the next thing you know, you just have to plug it out from the wall and leave it there for 3 days to thaw out. Like, you develop all of this deep, deep, deep sense, you know. Whereas, you know, in my experience, sadness, those kind of things, they can be dealt with on a day-to-day basis by just getting up and taking action you know, distracting yourself and saying, and using, like, you know, I find, you know, I always think whenever things are black, I always try and sit myself down and say, okay, but you know, in 3 days' time, you'll feel differently. Just keep going, keep going. And you can use techniques like that to keep you not jolly yourself along, but to kind of, you know, remind yourself that nothing is like, this too shall pass. But if you dig into a situation, into a rut whereby you're dependent on tablets, then it's not going to pass at all.
Yeah, exactly. It's that the challenge is to see is to have a long perspective and to not get defeatist. I mean, it's there's a lot more that could be said about that, but I'll keep it brief for now.
It's a big one. It's a big one, and it's a dangerous one, because one of the things you got to remember is, in Ireland particularly, Big Pharma owns Ireland, you know. So thou shalt not speak against Big Pharma.
Dear God. All right. The British state has come down hard on policing public opinion since Starmer. Is Ireland any better off in the face of contrived outrage onslaught? Well, I think you've addressed that, but is there anything you'd want to say briefly about that?
Well, just that, no, it's just as bad, I think. You know, I think in many ways it's, you know, there's all this constant air of menace, of lies about people, attempt to smear people, and it's shocking. Starmer is, I think, you know, I take your point earlier about the legislation was a conservative law, but he's gung ho for all that stuff.
It feels like it should have been Starmer who wrote it.
Yeah, it was written for him, for his benefit, I think, ultimately, as he sees it.
Does John feel a sense of community has developed to ensure the livelihood, well-being and flourishing of society's heretics since his first appearance on Millennial?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
A sense of community. Has any sense of community developed to ensure the livelihood, well-being and flourishing of heretics like you and me?
I don't think so.
I wouldn't say so.
No, I don't feel that. I think things have deteriorated somewhat within what we call the resistance. I think it's beginning to become quite flaky and really egomaniacal and vindictive and quite nasty at times, you know. And I feel it's much less supportive now than it was 3-4 years ago. I feel more like a lone gunner now, so to speak, metaphorically speaking.
Would you say that COVID sort of brought a sense of solidarity to people who otherwise would be disagreeing with each other?
For a while, yes. In the resistance sense, I don't take that point. I don't believe that happened. They say it did, but I think that was short lived. But I think for the first few years, once people came out and started to agitate a little bit, there was about 3 years of a pretty strong feeling. But then I think the way that the thing was just dragged out, you know, and I think that was a deliberate strategy to demoralize. It worked, and people became more and more fragmented. They started infighting. I mean, in Ireland, for example, 3 years ago, there was at least three, if not four, you know, alternative nationalist parties on the go, you know. Now they're all over the place. You know, they're gone pretty much. They're not functioning. They may exist in some, you know, on paper somewhere, but they're not out there. And you know, there's really not a resistance now, except, as I said earlier, the individual people who are using internet platforms by and large, to speak and to try and raise consciousness and encourage people and bring
This is why I always say to people, try not to fall out with each other. Like, really fall out with someone as a last, absolute last resort, because it always has repercussions for yourself and for that person and for lots of other people secondarily. It retards community, it retards function. And so I think that people should really try just to put beefs aside.
It's not always easy, you know. I mean,
oh yeah, people, I know.
If people behave in reprehensible ways and lie and all the rest of it, then you kind of say, no, you got to say goodbye, you know.
Oh yeah, don't I know it? Yeah, I've had those experiences as well. I take the point. Okay. Love and Vision says, I discovered John on Odyssey and have been a big fan since. I admire his passion. I think we all do. Ghost Dog Man said, encouraging discussion, gentlemen. Thank you. You're welcome. Love and Division, is the idea of subjective offense good for civilization? Would it be possible to draw up a list of objective offenses? That's a huge question. I don't want to get into it now. I think it relates to having a core ethos in your society, and then things which offend that ethos, which denigrate it or contradict it, those are the things which are offensive. And that's going to be the case with any group of people. The issue now is that the ethos is so artificial and manufactured and foreign to the people and antithetical to their existence.
Yes. So, it's a completely spurious value system that is replacing the one that actually worked because it was organic to the circumstances of the people.
Exactly. Dubuni Warrior, as a backup plan, what do you think about Europeans solidifying around the Amish in Indiana? Since the Amish are European, and if they were a nation, they would have the highest birth rate on Earth. Well, again, it's a huge question. I'll just answer that briefly. I think that we might end up learning from the Amish. I think we might end up copying some of their techniques.
Only post-catastrophe, I think.
Yeah. And then finally, Chief Noticer says, keep up the good work, John. Great to see the rise of some new voices from ERA this year as well. Well, I'll try to have them on Millennial next year. So, all right. Sorry about that rush going through the super chats, but I realized that I'd lost track of time, which is very unprofessional of me. But the conversation was so interesting. And I always think, if we could chat for 3 or 4 hours, that would be great.
Colin. We almost have. But yeah. It's been very interesting for me as well. I hope people got something from it. It's because this is the thing, you know, really. Ultimately, the only thing we have is the capacity to talk and to get that conversation out there so that it continues and grows and people hear and they kind of hear something that resonates with their feelings that would make them think again about other things they maybe have taken for granted that are actually not true.
And let them know that they're not alone.
Yes.
I think that's crucial. Mm. That's crucial.
That's right.
All right. Well, this has been a really good conversation, one of my favorites so far. So thank you for that. I'll be back very soon with the next interview. But in the meantime, John Waters, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you very much, Colin. And thank you, everybody, for watching and listening.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.